Welcome back to the TPN Podcast. I'm Matt, co-founder of the Pilot Network and one of your hosts for the TPN Podcast. It's a slightly different episode for you today, where I recently had the privilege to sit down with TPN's oldest member, Bill Braxton. He's just a few months from celebrating his 100th birthday and has been an absolute goal of mine to interview him for some time now. We talked about life both in and out of the cockpit, and I tried to soak up as much wisdom as I could along the way. Bill loved two women in his life, both of which you'll hear him talk about during part of his story. I'd like to take the opportunity to dedicate this episode to his late wife, Nellie, who I had the privilege to meet before her recent passing. Because Bill and I recorded nearly 2 hours of audio, this is going to be part one of a three-part series. I really hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Bill, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for sitting down with me. I really appreciate you being here.
You're welcome.
Let's start off with the easy stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about where you're from and how you got into flying?
My father was a cotton farmer and had eight brothers and sisters, all of them born in the same house on which everybody gets a laugh of, Chickenfoot Lane is still there today in a very, very busy street out of south of Fayetteville, North Carolina. Anyway, when I was 5 years old, almost six, farming, especially cotton farming, was terrible. And at that time, we had a national railroad strike. And Rocky Mount, North Carolina, had the Atlantic coastline, and the main maintenance shops were in Rocky Mount. And my father got a job there, so we moved to Rocky Mount when I started my first grade in the city schools, rather than the country school. Our country school was a one-room schoolhouse from the first to the eighth grade.
Nice.
I went one time with one of my brothers or sisters, and they had me, and I was 5 years old, I guess, and they had me sitting in the teacher's lap, and everybody in the class had to perform. Anyway, we moved to Rocky Mount, and I went through high school there. The North Carolina schools in the 1920s and 30s had only 11-year school. We didn't have the 12-year. We had 7 years elementary school and 4 years high school.
Sure.
So no junior high, anything like that. And if you lived in the city of Rocky Mount, you walked to school or got there the best way you could. Of course, the whole town was, at the most, you would be 2 miles or 2.5 miles from any place. So I walked to school, did all right in school. And when I graduated, I was something like the third or fourth one in my class. And the principal asked me if I wanted to go to college. I didn't even know what he was talking about. That very idea of anybody in my area going to college was unheard of.
Sure.
He got a job at Duke University as director of admissions. So I got a scholarship. He and a friend of mine were the top ones in our class, and we went hitchhiked up to Durham, North Carolina, where Duke University was. And I spent about 2 weeks. I had no money. I had a dime. Gentleman who had been our superintendent says, "I can't get you a job. The jobs are all taken by the rich kids and all this stuff, you know." And I had a brother in the Army at that time, and he was writing to me because, of course, we were pretty close when he was at home. But he'd already been in the Army 3 or 4 years, and he told me, "Well, come in the Army. You get paid. You get everything is free." You know, so. So that's what I did. I decided to join the Army.
Okay.
I was 17 years old.
What did you do for your first job in the Army?
The only thing, opening, I had to wait about 3 or 4 months when I applied to it for admission. Anyway, I was a private, and they sent me to Panama in the infantry.
Okay.
And handed me a Springfield rifle and said, you sleep with it, you live with it, and this is what you will die with it if you stay long enough.
Sure.
And I went to Panama and worked on the canals on the Pacific side of the ocean and hated this kind of, everything about this thing was just so miserable because as a private at our base, all we did in the morning, we'd get up, go out, and we'd drill for maybe an hour, marching around with a rifle on our shoulder.
Sure.
All World War One activities, digging holes, digging trenches,
right,
and this kind of stuff. And bayonet practice, and I wasn't very good at that.
And what year was this?
I did about 3-4 months, and my brother was in Panama at the time, but he was on the Atlantic side, and he was in the Coast Artillery. And so he says, why don't you transfer? I said, you don't do it this way. He was a corporal in the Army, was a big shot in those days. Anyway, he arranged to have me transferred to the Coast Artillery. To his base was on an island off the Atlantic coast, and there I spent the rest of my enlistment and worked with the big 16-inch guns. But we could do things with those because we had to plot courses, and the enlisted man had a big part in everything.
Sure.
You had a bunch of young lieutenants fresh out of West Point that ran everything. But and I liked all that, but I saved my money. In those days, you could buy your way out of the Army.
Oh, really?
And of course, I had 3 years to do, and it cost $150 to get out. And I was making $21 a month, and all over 20 of that went into the bank.
Sure.
And it took me almost a year to save $150. And I bought my way out, went back to Rocky Mount. There was nothing to do. The Depression, 1935, 36, that area. And so I stayed around there about a month and a half. And my father was after me every day, get a job. There aren't any jobs. He didn't have a job himself. So I said, well, I'm going back in the Army. Well, Fort Monroe was the head of the Coast Artillery.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I would go up to Fort Monroe and enlist, and maybe I could get a job at the headquarters. And while I was on a streetcar in Newport News going out to Fort Monroe to enlist, there's a big sign in Hampton, Virginia, join the Army Air Corps, be a pilot, all this. How do I do this? I got the conductor, I said, how do I get to Langley Field? Which was right there.
Sure.
He said, well, you get off at the next stop and transfer and go out. I went out to Langley, and they grabbed me with open arms. They said, we don't have many high school graduates coming in here, and you already got a year and a half service, so you don't have to go to boot training or any of that.
Had you ever thought about aviation before that?
Had never thought about flying. That was a father's thing. An enlisted man didn't fly. That was the officer's. And so I was at Langley, and the first thing they did at Langley said, well, you don't have any skill, so we're going to send you to a court reporter school. And that was at Fort Monroe. But anyway, they sent me over there, and I was number one in my class. I was the only high school graduate in the class. And they sent me back to Langley and put me in the sergeant major's office as a court reporter. And, of course, at that time, the Air Corps was, I don't think we had but about 900 officers in the whole Air Corps. And Curtis LeMay was one of the lieutenants there.
I know the name.
He ran a navigation school for the pilots, but he was a pilot himself. And I had to take a couple of court-martials where he was the staff judge advocate.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of watched out for me there for, oh, maybe the next year and a half, making sure I got a good assignment or something. But I stayed at headquarters, and eventually, later on, after I became an officer, I became the adjutant for Langley Field, the base adjutant.
Sure.
I don't know if they had base adjutants any of your time. It was the administrative officer for the base.
Okay, okay.
But I worked that for the 3 years. It was a 3-year enlistment. And 1939, the war broke out in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And the Air Force went crazy. They got money for Congress. The B-17s came in the Air Force. And for fighter planes, we had some North American made a fighter plane. Wasn't much of a fighter plane. It was, some of them were two-place, some of them were single.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have anything to do with the flying end of it. I was working in headquarters. And when 1939, of course, things just exploded. And I had been a private now for 5 years almost. I ended up as a master sergeant in less than a year.
Oh, wow.
Or right about the year. And the main reason for that, some colonel called me one day and wanted to know if I could take letters.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the GHQ Air Force, which at that time was the headquarters of the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And we did everything in Langley instead of Washington. Bowling Field later on became the headquarters. But anyway, I went to work for this colonel, and first thing you know, I was the very first month he promoted me to sergeant, and he says you can't work here in Air Force headquarters as a private. We don't have privates here. We moved our headquarters to Bowling Field, and the Japs hit Pearl Harbor on December the 7th. And I was a tech sergeant at that time. Of course, I thought I was 10 times higher than I thought I should have ever been.
Sure.
But I was working for this colonel, so he was taking care of me.
Right.
So the day after Pearl Harbor, he called me in. He says, are you all ready to go overseas? I said, I guess if we're going, we go. And he says, well, I've got my orders, and I want you to go along with me. And I said, Colonel, I sure would like to be a master sergeant. And he said, well, we'll think about that.
Negotiating your way up. Do you remember that? Do you remember December the 7th?
Oh, yeah. Very well.
How did you feel that day?
Nellie and I, my wife who was here with me, she was at that time about 16, 17. She was a senior in high school.
Okay.
And she was with me, and we rode down to Yorktown. We were sitting on the York River with a lot of other people around. And we got the message on Pearl Harbor about, I guess, 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they said, report back to your base and all this. But I was stationed in Washington, and this is Gloucester, Virginia, Yorktown, Virginia.
Sure.
And 150 miles from Washington. I said, well, I had a pass for the weekend. I'm gonna stay here. I'm not going back right away. So Nellie and I think we went to the movies or something. Anyway, I went on back. We got engaged. I said, would you marry me when the war's over? Oh, yeah, sure. Who knew anything about the war? And she didn't even know from nothing about Pearl Harbor, anything else. But I went on back to Washington, and the colonel says, we've got our orders. We're going to the Philippines. And he says, I want you to go with me. Well, okay, that's what you did in the Army. You went wherever they sent you.
Sure.
I went with him, walked over to the hospital to get your shots and all that. He took 6 or 8 shots. He walked out the door of the inoculation place, passed out, had a heart attack.
Oh, no.
I says, this messed up everything. He says, we're not going anywhere, not right away anyway. So, he was in the hospital there at Bowling Field, and about a week or 10 days later, he was getting so he could sit up and everything. He says, the Pentagon, this new big building they're building, was just getting ready to open, and we won't have enlisted men. They won't be allowed in the Pentagon. He says, be officers only.
Mm-hmm.
What do I care? I don't care. And he says, you can go anywhere in the United States you want to go. I said, well, send me back to Langley Field where I'd already been for 5 or 6 years.
Sure.
And, of course, Nellie was there just in her senior year in high school.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I got back to Langley, I walked the door, and the base commander called me in. He says, hey, got something for you. And he says, you've just been appointed a warrant officer. The Air Force had never had warrant officers before.
Right.
But they had to pay me some 800 or 900 at a time. And because I was a tech sergeant, I got promoted to warrant officer. But he says, you got a problem here, though. Your orders for master sergeant just came in. Said, now you can be a warrant officer, master sergeant. I said, can I put my stripes on for one day? Yeah. He says, okay, we'll hold a warrant officer one day. It hadn't been a week after that. The base commander called me in again because I had been at Langley as an enlisted man 6 or 7 years.
Sure.
So I knew all the people at headquarters. And he says, warrant officers, you just made warrant officer? I said, we don't have any place for warrant officers here. He says, you know, the only thing that you can do is go to OCS. The Air Force had just opened the OCS in Miami Beach.
Okay.
So I hiked down the OCS, and when I got through, we didn't know where we were going. There were 2,000, Clark Gable's class.
Sure.
Yeah, and I'd see him every day, talk to him every day.
Now you knew him, huh?
That he was just another cadet like I was.
Right.
And he asked, I said, where are you going? He says, I'm going to gunnery school. I said, you're crazy. That's for enlisted men. You're going to second lieutenant now. You're not. He says, I know General Arnold. Hap Arnold was head of the Air Force.
Right.
And he gave me special permission to go to gunnery school. And he said, where are you going? I said, I don't know. And I went back to the barracks. I said, you know, I should do something about this. I wrote to my colonel friend, who at this time now was in personnel in the Pentagon.
Sure. What was his name? Do you remember?
I said, I want to go back to Langley Field. He said, that's no problem. He said, your orders will be there tonight. And sure enough, next morning I went down to report in, and there's my orders back to Langley Field. I get back to Langley. I'm an officer now. And the colonel says, well, you can't be the sergeant major anymore. He says, I need an assistant adjutant in the headquarters there. And he put me in there, and within a month, I had been transferred out to a fighter outfit.
Mm-hmm.
It was going overseas, combat. But I was the adjutant, not flying.
Sure.
And we had P-47s.
Okay.
And the guys took me up in an AT-6. Several times I went up on flight. And they were all after me, why don't you go to flying school? I said, you can't get out of this. We're ready to go overseas. You're not going to send me to flying school. And sure enough, I got orders to go to flying school.
Oh, wow. Do you know how that happened?
The farthest thing from my mind. I never thought about being a pilot or anything.
Did someone help you out, or do you know how you got those orders? Or it?
Well, the colonel was in the Pentagon.
Sure.
And I had a 10-day leave, and I went by to see him. He says, what are you in? I said, I'm in the 58th Fighter Group. I'm the base adjutant for the 310th Fighter Squadron. And he got over the corner of the thing. He had a big book about this thick. And he ran through it. He says, man, he says, you don't want to do that. You don't want to go with those people. He said, they're going to New Guinea. And I says, I can't get out. I says, we're alerted for combat. And he says, have one thing. You go be a pilot and they'll take you out. He says, you'll get off of the out of this outfit. And so I told him, I said, be a pilot? Pilot or what? Even then, I didn't know anything about flying.
Sure.
And I wasn't especially interested in it, except it was something to do. And
do you remember the colonel's name?
Yeah, Colonel Blair, Cyrus Blair. He was a World War I fan, which I found out after doing research on his book.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that when I was working for him. He had been World War I, and I think he'd shot down 3 or 4 airplanes.
Oh, wow.
Of course, by this time, he's getting ready to retire,
sure.
Physical retirement. And I went on, and for the next year and a half, I was in training, first through regular. In those days, we had primary, basic, and advanced, 2 months in each place. You'd get about you graduate with, you get your wings with about 200 hours, 220 hours.
That's about the same as it is now.
No, yeah, but I don't know. I don't know what you do now, but we had three areas, the East Coast, the Central, and the West Coast, and I just happened to end up in Ocala, Florida for primary flight. And I didn't see the colonel or hear from him for almost a year. And I went on and ended up, I wanted bombers because I had B-17s at Langley Field.
Sure.
And I had always thought, boy, it would really be something to fly those. The only trouble was they lined us the first day in flying school, lined us up on the parade ground, and somebody came along and put his hand on my head. He said, all you guys are fighter pilots. All guys 5'6" were fighter pilots. Everybody else, the big six-footers and that, were twin-engine pilots.
Sure.
And everybody thought, oh, fighter pilot, that's the real thing, man. But for the next year, every place I went, you'd go into a bar or anything, you'd be the biggest guy there.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went on, and when I got my wings, they put me in P-40s, fighter pilot training.
Very cool airplane.
Yeah. And I ended up at Waycross, Georgia, and I had about, I guess maybe 100, 110 hours or so. We got 120 hours.
Sure.
Flying time in the P-40.
Oh, wow.
But I had the misfortune of going to Sapelo Island on gunnery training, and I made a pass on the target, pulled up. We're about 11,000 feet out over the water, and the engine quit.
Oh, no.
Scared the hell out of me.
Did you get it started again?
It backfired and started up, and then it went kick off and on. We had an instructor pilot with us. He was flying right beside me. And he says, well, we better head to the shore. At least you have land on the beach or something. So turned over to Sapelo Island, which happened to be right there off the coast of Savannah. And I was up at 11,000 feet, and it tried to get it started. It would backfire. But pretty soon, smoke began to fill up the cockpit, and then the fire around my feet. And I told the pilot, I said, should I bail out? He says, use your judgment. It's not my problem.